Everyone, welcome to another episode of Escape from Plan A. It's Teen. I'm hosting with Jess. What's going on, Jess?
Yo, nothing much.
Very special returning guest, Kenny Hsu. What's going on, Kenny?
Hey, good to be back on.
Yeah, last time we talked, it was a somewhat different world. And since then, you know, I mean, you're a go-to voice in America, actually, for things related to affirmative actions. One of the most, I guess one of the topics that we've talked a lot too about on this pod. I think there's just so much to that topic, and you've been very outspoken, and you've written a book. We've talked about your book last time you were on, and now since we're in the sort of like post SFFA, post affirmative action world, I guess it would be, you know, we thought it'd just be super interesting to talk to you and get your thoughts on the whole journey.
Yeah, we actually did a pod on it ourselves. We actually read the ruling and this like really broke it down. And I gotta say, Kenny, like, I really actually, like, the thing that, like, when I reached out to invite you onto the pod, I really respected that you were just like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Without, like, even asking, like, what our positions were or anything. I really respect that willingness to just kind of, like, jump in there, like, screw it. Yeah, they can be antagonistic or they can be supportive. Like, we're just gonna go for it. That was kind of an interesting thing. Like, I've been reaching out to a couple of people on both sides of this aisle, and consistently, like the people who are, you know, very extremely mad about this ruling were pretty much uniformly unwilling to speak, like either like to me personally or even just like in the DMs, or much less willing to like come out and express themselves openly on the pod. Which I thought was just putting it out there was kind of an interesting like behind the scenes look at just how these kind of like how these appearances kind of take shape, like the mechanics of actually inviting someone, a guest on, and trying to invite them to speak on their positions and stuff. So, I mean, like, you've been on a real tear. For people who haven't been following, like, basically like every, like, it seems like every mainstream news channel that was covering this, and all of them were for like a period of like a week and a half, it seems like you were like the go-to guy for the pro, I don't know how to put, okay, the people who supported the Supreme Court decision in striking down affirmative action in SFFA. Did everyone just like reach out to you? Or like were you representing Students for Fair Admissions, or like just representing yourself, or how did they find you?
That's a good question. So I was sort of handed the role of being the unofficial spokesman of this case. I'm on the board of Students for Fair Admissions, if that means anything to you guys. I'm actually the only elected board member of Students for Fair Admissions, which has about 25,000 members. And they only elect one board member. So as some of you know, the president is Edward Bloom, who is sort of, the New York Times describe him as this like sneaky, covert operative, just putting everything in the Supreme Court. But I'm sort of, you know, an attack dog, basically. In the media, and I just acquired that reputation, and then suddenly I became affiliated with Students for Fair Admissions. But my passion about this case came long before I was officially affiliated with Students for Fair Admissions, if people don't know.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, like, what happened on that day, I knew I was going to get a lot of hits, and I got over 45 media hits that weekend. All mainstream outlets.
Yeah, but you were just living in that suit for you were talking it head on. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to bed at like 12 a.m., waking up at like 6 a.m. You know, I just, it was crazy. Just took naps like whenever I could. It was sort of like a media marathon. But basically what happened was, like, I knew I was going to get hits, but then I also consulted with a PR firm to make sure that I would get the hits that I wanted. The hits that I really wanted were CNN, basically. I wanted to get an NPR. I wanted to get on hostile networks because I just wanted them exposed for, you know, the BS justifications that they would give for Harvard's position. And I did. You know, you go watch my clips. Don't take my word for it, but, you know, you can go watch them on YouTube yourself.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, you were
this morning, that stuff. So yeah, that's sort of how it happened. So I did pay a little money to get a little extra PR attention, but I knew I was going to get PR attention anyway.
And this was through you, like SFFA wasn't covering that PR or like putting you like the media quests weren't coming through them to you, right? They were hitting you up personally.
They were hitting me up for sure. Okay, they're hitting me up, okay. And then I had a publicist who helped me to connect with a couple of CNN people too.
I mean, props to you. It's tough, like wandering onto.
Jess, I'm curious, who were you getting blanked by in terms of like people who were vehemently opposed, let's say, to SFFA's quest? Was it Asian American, you know, academic types? Okay,
I definitely knew that I wanted to speak to other Asian Americans, a couple of the blue check types that we've been calling out. Surprisingly, like I'm not blocked by very many people, so I'm still able to like just slide their DMs. Usually, I just get ignored. One person, an academic, we've been pretty vocal about, was pretty strongly like, if you are going to remotely support this decision, then I'm not going to have anything to do with this. It's like, well, like you realize, like, and this is a prominent academic who constantly, like 99% of the time, will constantly rail about these white supremacist institutions that are out to oppress people of color. And then, like, and then you're talking about, like, if you're like being against this decision, since it's not Black people on trial, it's not Asian people on trial, it's fucking Harvard on trial, right? Like, you want, mm-hmm. like, if I'm not gonna be willing to be pro Harvard, then you don't want to talk to me. Like it's an ideologically ludicrous position. Like at any other time, for any other situation, they'd be first to call Harvard a like white supremacist, rotten, corrupt institution. But all of a sudden, you bring like affirmative action in the picture, and then now like the quote correct position to take is being pro Harvard, whatever that means. Like I just thought that was just such a brain dead position to take. That's just emotional. But without even really any like founding for that emotionality either. So just, I really wanted to talk, like to really break that down, but they weren't willing to. So, you know, okay, sure. We're going to talk to the person who wants to talk to us. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to this conversation here. Mm. So Kenny, I was going to like, even on a total media marathon, like if you don't mind, like, do you mind sending us a couple links to like appearances that you're particularly proud of? Like there's one of my favorites where you were speaking on CNN and then like the host just kind of like shut you off, was just kind of like, okay. And next segment. Cause it was like a point, you know?
Yeah. Well, she was trying to shut me off, but I actually was able to get in one last parry. She was like, well, I don't think the standards are lowered for Black Americans, but Kenny Hsu, nice to see you. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The standards are lowered for Black Americans. Hold up. 273 points, SFFF data confirmed by the court. Standards are lowered. And then she was like, Kenny Hsu, thanks for coming. But
yeah, yeah, like,
you know, I couldn't let her get away with
it. I personally think it's rhetorical, obviously, but I think what pisses me off is not that framing, but the frame. I mean, what the framing that I think of is that no, it's standards are raised for Asian students, right? But I don't care whether they're lowered for Black students or whatever. The problem is, and they're always focusing on Black and Latino students, and they're avoiding white students. And my thing is like, look, I mean, the thing about this case that really annoys me is that Asian students are held to a different standard, period. You know, you can call it lowering standards of other groups, or you can call it raising standards of our groups. And Roberts, I think, said this, like, you know, race is never used as a negative, only a positive. He's like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. If you inevitably fall back on stereotypes, which means you are typing people based on race. So we've come right back around full circle to that argument there. I mean, it was one of the things that outraged me most about the reception to, and I think it's lazy thinking, lazy ideologically bound thinking. But the entire case was, you know, the heart of it was, did Asian American students suffer from racial discrimination in this case? That's the heart of it. And you have whatever conclusion you want to draw based on the ruling, it has to start there, that Asian American students were facing discrimination. You can have two opinions about this. You can say like that's fine or that's bad, but you have to at least accept that it was happening. So this quicksand like rhetorical argumentation that was going on, which is both that if both that Asian Americans weren't being discriminated against. And, oh, look, over there, we're actually going to be looking at black and brown students. Not, no, the heart of it was about Asian Americans here.
Yeah, Jess, that was, you know, Kenny, this is something that we talked about in our own pod where we're looking at this strictly from a legal perspective. It's like, look, everyone's pinning this onto like a conservative court, but the fact of Asian, and I mean that in the legal sense, the fact of anti-Asian discrimination was determined at the district court level. And that was in Boston. That was in the hometown of Harvard. And they lost, I mean, SFA lost the court, the case.
Yeah.
But the, it was on the record. There was a factual finding that there was discrimination. They just found that it was legal. That's, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but yeah, I mean, the, I was disappointed to see how the media immediately went to how this harms black Americans, how this harms.
Well, clarify, because I want to get into the specifics. Talk about the complexities there, because I think I want people to really understand this case.
Okay, sure. So district court, basically, you know, the case had to progress through three levels of federal court, right? And so at the district court level, that's when all of the data about Harvard's admissions was revealed. That was like back in 2018. This is 2023, guys. So this case has been around for like 6-7 years. So back in 2018, we got somebody, Students for Fair Admissions got somebody to study the data. Harvard had their own economist, David Card, study the data. SFFA had an economist named Peter Sidiacono study the data, and they came to different conclusions about the data. David Card found no discrimination from Harvard against Asians, which that was the rationale the district court used. The justice, Alison Burroughs, was an Obama appointee, very much, you know, pro-affirmative action in general. So, and also, you know, she was constrained by Grutter v. Bollinger, so, which is the case that allowed limited affirmative, which allows affirmative action. So, but I contest in my book, An Inconvenient Minority, I don't care what the heck David Card said about Harvard discriminating against Asians. This, the Students for Fair Admissions analysis is the better analysis. And the reason why is because David Card's analysis assumes that Harvard's use of the personality score against Asians, which most people here know, gave Asians the lowest personality score out of all the races. Card assumed that it was Harvard's use of the personality score was legitimate. As in,
right, it's a bit of self-dealing.
It wasn't discriminatory. So if you include, if you factor in the personality score, then yeah, you the discrimination sort of disappears. It's still there, but it sort of disappears.
So you're saying there was on its face an agreement, because I remember at the summary judgment level, there was they found against Harvard to say, no, look, SFFA has shown enough of a pattern here that I think we need to move on to like a trial, right? We need to move into the discovery phase. We got to look into this.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is that Harvard was able to pull out some witness. So, I mean, obviously witness testimony is biased towards whoever's paying the witness, but they were able to pull stuff out to say, oh, look, there's what looks like discrimination on its face isn't discrimination because there's this other personality. I don't think it's called a personality score. It's a personal score that is actually kind of where things leveled out. That's why you're seeing the sort of discrepancies in test scores and GPAs and stuff like that, right?
Right, because Asians are lowest in personality, and that's the third factor for how Harvard grades. In fact, it's determinant in like 80% of admissions. It's nearly impossible to get into Harvard if you don't have a 2 or higher on the personality score.
So Kenny, this is, help me understand this, because I've never fully understood this about Harvard's position. If Harvard's saying that they don't they're not doing any racial discrimination, which is what they said no single student has had their admissions decision, you know, decided by race or anything like that. Why are they defending affirmative action? This is the thing I don't quite get about their position. They're saying like, we're not really using race, but yet we still want we still want to defend the right to use race.
Because they're freaking liars. That's why.
This is inconsistent, right?
Out of their cereal bowl in the morning at 7 a.m. when they get up out of their Ivy League luxury bed, because they are discriminating against Asians and they want Asians to be discriminated. So their true position is they want racial preferences against Asian Americans. They wouldn't be spending $40 million plus on legal fees if they didn't want discrimination against Asian Americans.
What do you make of
discrimination against Asian Americans? Because it sounds bad, but their true position is discrimination against Asian Americans.
What do you make? Because I'm asking this genuinely because I haven't looked into it and I don't know what it means. But I've heard that since this lawsuit was filed, that subsequent classes at Harvard, the number of Asian, the percentage of Asian students went up dramatically to over 25%. Whereas before it was claimed to.
Yeah, it's true. Still discriminating. Asians would make up 38 to 43% of Harvard if they were graded on academics alone.
So, no, I'm just curious what you think that means, though. Why was the number increasing over that period? Was this in reaction to the lawsuit, or was this just some other
reason? I think it was in reaction to the lawsuit. Yeah, I think that there was some pressure among the faculty to try to dress up the numbers a little bit.
Yeah. And so where do you think that leaves us, you know, with this? Because, you know, I view the Supreme Court ruling as being larger than affirmative action. I think there's a conservative, there's long been a conservative legal project, I would say, to go back on a lot of 14th Amendment jurisprudence. So I actually connect this case to, you know, to the whole overturning of Roe, the Dobbs case.
Yeah.
But that I think is beyond the interest of most people who were brought into affirmative action because specifically of the discrimination that occurs in higher learning admissions, right? So what do you think this leaves us in terms of, because I hear so many takes of like, you think that this brings back meritocracy? No, it's going to be the opposite. The elite universities are just going to drop academic scores altogether. And, you know, they're just going to go by a completely different scale now where, you know, instead of holding Asian students to a higher standard, they just won't be even looking at GPA. And
right. So everything goes to a soft metric. So like you said, like being able to, like just on academics alone, 38 to 40 some percent, we're no longer able to get that kind of data anymore. If you take out like the SAT or GPA or something, all of which have been floated in various circles that these schools are trying to implement. I don't know. My personal say from the reading of the ruling from Roberts' majority opinion, like I'd love to get your take on this. Is this directionally correct or not? It seemed like Harvard was going to the mats to kind of defend their own like black box policy. So it's really just to retain power over their admissions process. Like Roberts, like it's a pretty epic line. Roberts calling them out, saying the Harvard's position on the use of race in their admissions is essentially, quote, trust us, right? So they could not produce firm metrics on the general benefits of diversity on campus. They could not point to any concrete measures for that could be placed under judicial review. So it seemed like really just it's an institution trying to protect its own ability to manage itself. Does that seem like an accurate read? Like, yeah. It's asking for a space outside the law if it came to that by saying like this narrow exception for the use of race carved out by Bakke, right? Mm-hmm. That diversity, first of all, like diversity was never legal as like reparations for past harm. But there was a narrow exception that, you know, campuses had discretion over the, like the general, you know, benefits of diversity on campus. So that's the exception that they were dragging to the mats to defend their position on this.
Yeah. I mean, I can answer every question that you guys just threw at me, but before we get to the specifics, I just want to very much clarify the big picture here. When I grew up, like as a kid, and you know, I read, you know, American-born Chinese, and I'm mostly talking to an Asian American audience here, and people who are sympathetic with Asian Americans. So, I think I can say this, you know, and I cared about Asian status in America. Harvard University is the number one progenitor of anti-Asian prejudice in America. They're the number one progenitor. There is no institution even close. And I was fortunate enough in my life to identify that early on in my life where I was able to make, you know, a stand against that. It was when I grew up, it was literally my God-given mission to defeat like the number one most prejudiced institution against Asians in America, which is Harvard University. And that is really what the Supreme Court does. It is a huge boost for Asian American status in America today, and a deserved boost because Asians fought for it and Asians deserve it based on merit. So I don't want to get into like, you know, we will get into the specifics. We will get into how Harvard will try to avoid it. But I just wanted to say that right off the bat. This is a huge win for Asian Americans specifically.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. We can go into the more details on that. I kind of want to tease out the specifics of that. But directionally, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this like it goes back to the ultimate point of the case and how badly the media tried to hide that this was ultimately about a case of racial discrimination against a minority, one of the smallest minorities in racial minorities in America. And the fact that this is actually a win in the realm of racial justice was completely, completely submerged. I found that outrageous. Yeah. Like, how do liberal-minded people who ostensibly stand for racial justice and, you know, the righting of inequality, the righting of historical wrongs, you look at this and your immediate reaction is to demonize the group that was leading this? Like, to me, that's just mind-boggling and a real eye-opener. I imagine a lot of Asian Americans saw this reaction and there are some thoughts brewing in the general population.
You have to in some ways sort of viscerally hate your own culture of achievement to dislike this ruling if you're Asian American. And unfortunately, I do know some Asian Americans who are cynical enough to hate that. But yeah, I mean that's not my position.
Well, I think the difference is merit versus status. You know, I think there's people who love status, but merit is sort of a side. It's not merit. Merit runs a distant second. Yeah. I think
I like,
to a lot of
I
people
like
in
status acquired by merit. That's what I like. I think that Asians should get the status that they deserve by merit. That's the position that I will take on that.
That's an interesting one. I want to pick up on that later. But yeah, we're getting farther away. You said you wanted to respond and answer to some.
I mean, there's a lot of. Sorry, that was big picture because I needed to get that out. Small picture. You asked, is Harvard going to skirt the ruling? The answer is yes. Harvard will try to skirt the ruling. So we will, fortunately, people at Harvard, and Harvard is a rich enough and big enough target that there will be plenty of ways to sue Harvard to get them to fully comply with the ruling. It will happen in future district court rulings now that Grutter v. Bollinger is effectively overturned and Harvard's admissions policy is remanded and they have to make a new admissions policy that doesn't discriminate against Asians. That is the court order. They have to do that and they will not do that. It has to satisfy the court. Basically, it's like a Brown v. Board of Education for Harvard specifically. So yeah, Harvard will try to skirt it. UNC, I think their response was a lot better. They said they will fully comply and obey the ruling. Harvard's response was defiant, like they wanted to disobey the law. So I like UNC's chances coming out of this better. But no, I mean, of course, you know, that's just the way that legalities work. But I do predict that by 2030, Harvard's racial demographics will properly reflect where they should be in a merit-based economy.
You know,
do you believe in just a quick question? Do you believe in Harvard's power as an elite-making institution?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, okay. There's a reason people want to. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's totally not a gotcha. It's just one thread of the many that kind of led into my thinking on this. It's part of the part of the tension here is that we all had an eye towards Harvard because we knew that it had like king making abilities, right? Like if you go to Harvard, you carry that brand with you, you make the connections, you know, I think the actual education itself is kind of a secondary factor here. It's just the fact that you went to Harvard that gives you a sort of boost in the society. And especially for people who are relatively new to the country, that has some capital that has some value as capital, social capital, and economic capital as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it does.
But there's a little bit of tension there because, like you said, you know, you identified Harvard very early on as a major, if not the most anti-Asian institution in the country, promulgating and propagating, you know, discrimination against Asian Americans here. There's a little bit of tension then, like that our desire to gain entry to this institution that has historically been against us. It's kind of like reaffirming its kingmaking status here. It's a bit of a catch-22. Like for instance, like when we talk about these admissions, I noticed one thing that was completely left out of the equation was like the possibility of expanding the number of seats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, and I think the we had like the tension that Teen brought up, right? There's this uneasy relationship between like merit and status here, right? If the ruling was saying like, no, Harvard, you have to accept everyone above a certain threshold, and this could like triple or quadruple or quintuple your class size, that effectively that dilutes its status making power. So I noticed like there was never an argument that says that like Harvard should be forced to accept everyone past a threshold. It's we're accepting the terms of the game that we have this very limited number of seats and it's allocating each seat that's at stake here.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really a question here. Just kind of like unspooling a thread that was going through my mind here. Like part of the tension here is like, okay, Harvard is racist. Then one valid reaction is fuck Harvard then. I don't want to go there. I don't want my children to go there. And the other option is no, we're going to force Harvard to accept, you know, to abide by rules that seem more fair to me. But one stance definitely reaffirms and kind of reifies Harvard's unique ability to mint social elites. As opposed to like more... Points. I mean, like, I think, like coming from the West Coast, I think that like, the power of the Ivies is substantially less because we have our own institutions going up, powerful, you know, educational institutions, right? We have, like, our own, like, quote, Harvard, right? We have Stanford, we have Caltech, we have, you know, a very strong, very, very distinguished UC system.
Yeah, and you banned racial preferences as early as 1994.
Right. So I mean, just kind of spitballing here, like this weird tension between merit and status here is just one that I've been kind of wrestling with personally. Like, which one are we valuing more here, or is there a way for this to coexist that doesn't, you know, end up, you know, blowing up in our faces later on? Mm-hmm. Like, if like I don't know if you saw like Jeff Yang weighing in on this whole thing. I think he said the quiet part out loud, basically. When he's arguing with someone about, you know, his own son's, you know, college chances, and then he just responds to someone, would you really want to go to a school with what, 60% Asians? Like, and the answer is it's implied, obviously not. That would be terrible.
According to the generic white people that I talk to all the time on talk radio. Yeah. These are mostly conservative people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who I talk to all the time on radio for various things, including promoting my new book, School of Woke. Don't let the right-wing title confuse you. It's going to be a really good book on our K-12 schools and why they're failing for Black Americans. But I've talked a lot on right-wing radio and conservative white radio, and they're like, I don't care. I don't care that Harvard's 60% Asian. I mean, I would send my kid to that all the time. So it's not like every American, they wouldn't care. Or, you know, you could say they're unconsciously biased. They would say that, but I have no reason to believe that. I think that it's a segment of these people that care.
Okay.
Just, I think, you know, the contradiction you're raising is very interesting, right? It's like, why are we trying so hard? I mean, SFFA spent millions of dollars fighting for the right to attend an institution that they have proven is highly anti-Asian. Why would you want to go there, right? I would say, though, that in defeat, my thinking about Harvard has changed a bit, which is that Harvard is not just an institution. It's also contested space. I wouldn't doubt, and I know this at least to a degree to some professors that I either know or have read about. Adrian Vermeule as an example, right, at the law school. And I think to an extent, Jeannie Suk-Gerson also kind of sees this. Harvard is not monolithic at all. It does, you know, it has tenured professors who do have academic freedom. And I do think that there is maybe a minority of a faction there, but I think it's growing in influence that in defeat, this other faction that is against the, I think the excesses of the of Bill Fitzsimmons's admissions department, you know, I think they're going to have a little bit more sway at Harvard now, right? And I've even noticed post SFFA that the New York Times, as another, you know, leading elite liberal institution, paper of record, was surprisingly mute and almost sort of, they were almost a bit sanguine about the whole thing. And they had, I forget the name of that, they had that professor from, they had that black professor come in and write a whole thing about how affirmative action is really not what it's a different beast than when it was devised. There's a ton of problems with it. The culture that has come up around it is extremely problematic. They had another one piece about how if you really care about black students, this case isn't really that relevant. This is a tiny sliver of a minority. I mean, you know, really you're talking about, we need to focus more about, you know, the base infrastructure of public education. That's a much more important thing that we got to talk about. They seem to be shying away from this. And I thought that in defeat, it kind of revealed that there might be more forces aligned against this stuff than we had previously thought when it was the law. I don't know, Kenny, if you're picking up on that, but that's what I'm seeing.
But I want to remind you in the audience that to not take for granted that the New York Times is sanguine on it. They accepted defeat. The New York Times accepted defeat long before this ruling because we were right. And we pushed, you know, and we push and put media pressure on them. And they knew it. They know it deep in their hearts that we're right. So they're not willing to come out, like, for example, what they did after Roe v. Wade. Because Roe v. Wade, the right had never conquered the public narrative on abortion the way the right has conquered the public narrative on affirmative action. And like right now, 75% of Americans don't believe race should be in college admissions, you know, including majorities of blacks, Hispanics, and Asians.
Do you remember, Jess, do you remember that tweet by Stop Asian Hate that just straight up lied about that? They cited article, and the Vox article didn't even support what they were saying, that 70% of Asians supported affirmative action. They actually had community guidelines come out and say, actually, the article doesn't even say that.
Showed that a significant majority of Asian Americans, I forget the exact number, but probably in the 70s somewhere, were generally supportive of like making sure that my policies and ensure that minorities were able to get a fair shake out there. But it was like, two questions down, when it's specific to college admissions, it was like 20% of Asian Americans were in favor of affirmative action as she was.
And that's a decline, by the way. That's a decline from 10 years ago, when actually more Asians supported race preferences. So
the contradictions have gotten too. Yeah. That's good to see, because the contradictions have gotten a little too extreme. Like if you're able to think two thoughts at once, you can see like just how untenable ideologically and practically this collection of policies we call affirmative action was to implement. It caused everyone problems at all levels. So it's actually good to get some like clarity, like legal clarity around what can and cannot be done with respect to race in these policies, which doesn't preclude like putting new laws on the books, if I'm not mistaken, right?
It doesn't preclude what, sorry?
Well, it's kind of an interesting like meta theme for the Supreme Court rulings. Like they come out and we all treat them like it's like Nerd Super Bowl or something. We all like argue over the results or something. And then kind of leave it. But like it seems like in a lot of these cases, sometimes what the justices are saying is that it's actually a little bit inappropriate to be relying solely on a Supreme Court ruling. Like the legislative branch can definitely like Roe v. Wade, the most recent Supreme Court case on Dobbs?
Dobbs, no. Yeah.
Dobbs, yeah. And we mentioned this on the pod we did about affirmative action too. Like it's made explicit that the justices say like, okay, like all you guys have to do, you guys meaning like lawmakers, all you have to do is just put a law on the books about abortion.
Right.
Like, that's all you guys have to do. You guys
they've been saying
that, that
for decades. They've said they were saying that, in fact, id Roe itself, you know. Yeah. But you know, it's a political calculation. They want to punt it to an institution that's not politically, you know, it's not politically exposed, you know, the way Congress is.
No, I actually think the Supreme Court made the right and logical decision in both SFFA and Dobbs. Like, Dobbs, their decision was right because Roe is not constitutional. I mean, what, like a trimester system in the Constitution? What the, who the heck made that?
I disagree with you, but I agree with you, but from a different direction. Yeah. Which is, I don't think Roe was ever really that protective of abortion rights anyway. And I think that if liberals were serious about it, and I am serious about it myself, mm-hmm. I think I would like to see that law in the books. But Obama, probably among the most outspoken about this or frank about it, mm-hmm. they didn't want to waste political capital on it. And so they relied on Roe. They made Roe out to be a heroic win for liberals. And it's not. It's a really poorly written, half measure. It's both everything that it's both what liberals wanted and totally anathema to what liberals wanted. And nobody really read the
And so is affirmative action. And so is Grutter. Race as a plus factor? Oh, you're not allowed to use quotas, but race could be a plus factor in admissions? How the heck does that supposed to work?
Yeah. Harvard, no, I agree. We were talking about this. I think that the reason that Bakke rejected historical redress, which I think would have been a much better basis for affirmative action and much more in line with, it would have been much more in line with things like the Freedmen's Bureau and stuff, right?
Yeah.
I went to University of Maryland. I won a scholarship there, a full merit scholarship, the year after the Fourth Circuit in Maryland's Fourth Circuit or whatever. Said that the scholarship that the University of Maryland had earmarked only for black students that were clearly qualified because they had already gotten in and they demonstrated such a high level of academic achievement that the school wanted to give them money to attend, mm-hmm. struck it down as not consistent with the principles of affirmative action. And I'm like, wait, I thought affirmative action was supposed to help high achieving black students, but you struck it down? You know, and it turned out to be too much of a quota system and it didn't fit in line. And I think the reason is because they were scared. They wanted to do it. They wanted to support University of California. They wanted to support progressives, but they were scared to open up the Pandora's box of historical redress, because then that would pave the way towards a push for reparations. It would, you know, and so they said they did a half measure. And I thought Bakke and everything that came after that was a terrible half measure. And it was humiliating to have to go through the kind of shit that we had to go through in the discovery and trial process of SFFA, where they were basically like, no, Asian students deserve to be dinged, for having one-dimensional personalities. And I'm like, okay, so not only do Asians have to, quote, make way in this POC solidarity for black and Latino students, but we don't even get thanked for it. We just get, I mean, the arguments are totally inconsistent. It's like, Asians have to make way for the greater good, but also you're not making way at all. Fuck all of you. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
Okay.
I'm going to drive this. Well, anyway, just quickly, just to drive that conversation home from what you said, Teen. The Asians, people ask, well, are Asians a wedge? Heck yeah, they're a wedge. Heck yeah. They're a wedge in the affirmative action dichotomy. But understand, it's not the Asians' fault that they're a wedge. It just so happens that if you have race preferences and you get to this stage, that Asians are just going to be the victims, and eventually something like this was going to have to happen. Now, I'm glad it happened when it did, but yeah, Asians are the wedge. And but I hopefully did at least a service to Asians in the sense that I helped Asians to realize this is also about their own dignity rather than just being pawns in, either the right wing or the left wing.
I agree. I thought the whole thing was supremely undignified. And I'm glad that they just threw that whole fucking, that whole genre of cases or whatever. Just please, no more. It was just undignified.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was cathartic in a sense. Like, I applied to college, you know, like 20 years ago, right? But I remember even then, like everyone knew what was going on. Like, I was applying to the Ivies, you know, getting advice from older people, you know, people had gone through the system or people had gotten rejected from the system. We were all talking about the Asian penalty. And we're talking like the late 90s into the early aughts here. So that means in implying that it goes even further back than that. Like, I was talking to people who graduated from college in the 80s who were talking about, you know, this discrimination against Asians. We had nothing to really base this on other than just being able to look at raw stats, stack it up, and then realize like the math just isn't mathing here. Like there's clearly discrimination, but being unable to pin it down. So like, I just want to personally thank like SFFA and your part in that organization to bring that to discovery, to see in such clear language, the words that Harvard admissions people were actually using to describe us. Mm-hmm. And it's in the ruling. Roberts was quoting that extensively in the notes, talking about the language these admissions officers were using to talk about their students in a really dehumanized, rote, stereotypical way, talking about like, oh, you know, stellar grades, stellar scores, but of course he's Asian. Like, whatever. Great scores for a Native American. I mean, this is so, like you guys said, undignified, and it exposed all of that. We finally have the concrete proof of that stuff, that like an entire generation plus of Asians and everyone else probably too, like, we just didn't know. We knew it was happening, but could not. We were not able to definitively prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So for a long time, like, Asians just had to kind of deal with this. Like, you got in. Maybe your personality just does suck, right? That's kind of the implicit thing you're supposed to carry with you if you get rejected by these institutions. Your personality probably did suck. You probably weren't leadership material. That's the kind of like, that's the thing that gets embedded in our psyches from a very formative age.
I do want to raise a little bit of a caution flag here, though. Now, I think the conversation can shift because of the, because of the victory, that we kind of move on to other considerations here, which is that I do think that there is a degree of truth, a large degree of truth, that Asians are being leveraged by both sides here, right? I do think that, for example, if you look at the way this case was talked about by the justices themselves, you know, the rights of Asian American students was not really really at the front of their consideration here, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that we were simply tools, but I'm saying that Asian Americans brought up an opportunity to question a larger system, not just affirmative action, but 14th Amendment, you know, interpretation at large. Okay, this is bigger than us. This whole thing is bigger than us. And I think Kenny, you're saying you're motivated by, you know, a very lifelong passion and dedication to stand up for Asian American rights, right? And I feel the same way. And I do find that, you know, as much as I appreciate, I think, some of the rationality that has been brought into this discussion on the rights, let's say broadly, I want to say that very broadly, okay? I don't think that the same people who would stand with Asians on this issue necessarily care about some of the other stuff that really is really troubling to me. For example, Biden's Department of Justice recently, has indicated that it's going to challenge the Florida law that restricts land ownership from it's not just Chinese citizens, but it's also a host of other unfriendly countries. But it's challenging that. And when I see that, I think this is sounding an awful lot like a cross between Japanese internment and Chinese exclusion. But I don't see the right standing up against that. I see Asians in Texas, for example, were similar. I mean, 34 states have these kinds of laws proposed. There's also federal legislation being proposed. I see Chinese Americans in Texas protesting, but I don't see a lot of, you know, white conservatives backing them up on that. So I'm just putting that caution out there. Well, I don't know if you have any response to that, but yeah.
So do you agree with the decision, the Students for Fair Admissions decision?
Yeah, I do on a legal basis, yes. And I've always felt that, and I feel very strongly about it, Kenny. I felt that I found it to be a great loss of almost like national identity, like American identity, to take the position that these young people, these young Asian people, simply don't have the right to stand up for what is actually the most important constitutional rights that they have, which is the equal protection under the laws, equal status. Mm-hmm. And to see the kinds of attacks that they were leveling against, I forgot the name of that one kid that Jeff Yang was going after. You know, just going after him like
oh,
a bully.
You know, the one he was slamming and like, oh, and by the way, he's Canadian.
Yeah.
So
he's a grown man. He's a grown man going after a 19-year-old kid. And I'm like, this kid is suing for his 14th Amendment right, and the Supreme Court sided with him. Who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Who are you? You know, why are you sitting here blabbering about, you know, you're bullying someone for doing something that I think is celebrated in it's as American lore, as Americans are supposed to have their day in court.
This is the heart of American civil law actually working as intended, so that anybody can pursue their interest. They feel they were wronged and they have the right to get heard.
Yes.
That's the core of it. It's working. In other words, they're mad that it was working.
But this is my point, is that I come from this from a more legalistic perspective to say, this has not changed my political alignments because I don't think I have a political alignment. I feel politically homeless in America. I'm not satisfied with either the left or the right. And I mean that, you know, Republican Party, Democrats or whatever, you know, the Republican Party in the states that they control, they have their own, you know, you say Harvard is the number one, discriminator of against Asians.
Yeah.
But I would say that there are in our history. And I think now we're repeating some of that history.
But yeah, go ahead.
What's that?
I mean, presently when I said that.
Oh, yeah. But I'm saying in our history, I would say that there are things that we're seeing being resuscitated now that are, to me, far scarier than, you know, what Harvard's done, which is obnoxious and humiliating. But, you know, I think that when you look at the revival of this idea of, you know, land ownership exclusions, which goes to the real heart of Japanese internment, it wasn't just the camps. It was the government appropriation of, you know, billions and billions of dollars worth of farmland that was at the heart of Japanese internment. And we're starting to see something similar. I'm not going to say it's the same, but, you know, attaching national origin to your right to own property in America. I don't think that's very American, but it's being proposed. It is a right-wing-led, Republican-led effort.
You mean national citizenry, not national origin. Chinese citizens.
Citizenry, yeah, exactly. And
you could just define me as a national origin Chinese, but I'm not.
Well, look, there's 34 different laws, and they're going to be varying according to what they define as you know, being from such countries, right?
Yeah.
There's a wide diversity. But, you know, citizenry status is not a valid basis for such discrimination. We know this.
Yeah. I disagree with the law. I disagree with that, with the whole idea that you should limit foreign control or investiture of land only from certain countries. You know, I think that that's... it's like there are bad actors in every country, and I think it has to be done on an individualized basis.
Well, absolutely. Imperial Japan was a real bad actor.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, look, the court in SFFA, Roberts took every opportunity. This is probably the third time Roberts has overruled Korematsu. I mean, they want to put the nail in that coffin, and I'm glad he did it. You know, I don't know if it's as closed as he hopes it is.
Yeah,
it's going to be harder to pry it back open.
Limitation of the court, the Supreme Court, they could overrule Korematsu an 80th time, but ultimately, you know, the people, the legislature, they still have the ability to sort of enact laws against that.
Yeah, that's been an interesting theme to tug at, you know, in constitutional legalism, or no, what's the word? The
Originalism?
Originalism, yeah. Like just reading through some of like Scalia's writings on this, you know, it seems like there's a certain class of law that's, you know, primarily geared towards restraining the power of the government. Mm. And then there's laws restraining the power of the citizenry. And like it falls along conservative versus liberal, but it's not an easy fit. It's a distinct class of focus, of judicial focus. Mm-hmm. This one seemed to be in the conservative camp in the very classic sense. It's restraining the power of the, it keeps asking the question in the ruling, like not directly, but indirectly saying, do you actually want the state to get into the business of discrimination based on race? Like discrimination can be negative, mm-hmm. which there's a lot of jurisprudence on. It can also be positive, which is what they were saying affirmative action was. It's a positive it's a positive schema of racial discrimination meant to aid a certain. Yeah. But the question ultimately is, well, do you want the state to have this power to begin with? And, you know, if I think along those terms, my answer to that is going to be no. I want my institutions, I want the state to be absolutely colorblind, which is distinct from civil society. Mm-hmm. I thought this was an important distinction that was kind of getting lost in the press, where everyone was kind of jumping on leveraging the force of the state to get what they want done onto other people. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to go back to drag that all the way back then, like, I just wanted to give you a chance, like in something other than like a 5-minute, you know, gotcha CNN segment. I wanted to talk through like your political orientation, like you get criticized as like right wing or something, like you're just towing the line for conservatives or the Republican mm-hmm. Party specifically. But I mean, you disagreeing with the land appropriation, like the land, what is it called? Like land restriction laws it means that like, I just want you to talk, like have the chance to talk through like what guides your political positioning. And, you know, insofar as you're out there talking to people, you know, trying to representing a certain point of view, what are you hoping that like other people, maybe especially other Asian Americans, take away from that kind of political positioning that you're that you're putting forth?
Mm. Well, I mean, I appreciate the opportunity for sure. I mean, the number one thing I care about is the truth, really. So, for example, like my positions on education, for example, like IQ is real. So, like, people were saying, like, oh, you know, racism is the cause of why Black achievement is lower. No, it's not. It's a very minor cause. The major cause is cognitive differences, and a second major cause is family structure, and a third major cause are poor policies at the funding level of the schools. You can have policies that could get Black Americans closer to the standard that we all wish we could have, but you can't completely change the racial achievement gap. So is that a liberal or is that a conservative position? I don't really care. It's the true position, you know? So
I mean, does that take you closer into do you distinguish by race then? Like, are you taking like an absolutist view of IQ that it's like an inherent inborn capacity, or like a flexible metric that encompasses things like class upbringing, family, you know, family structure, culture, you know, social priorities, stuff like that?
No, I mean, no, it's clearly both. It's clearly genetic and environmental. I mean, the science will tell you that that cognitive ability is both genetic and environmental. Usually in an early childhood is when it really gets formalized. All IQ is, by the way, your performance on like a series of 100 abstract questions divided by your age and compared with other people your age. That's all IQ is. It's not. It's nothing spooky. You know, it's like you want to get a better IQ, just do better at this cognitive ability test, this battery of exams here. So, you know, I mean, it's true though. I mean, so.
But then by that, just to clarify, I mean, by that metric, then currently, if let's say we just took an IQ survey of all children, in the United States right now, we would probably see a strong correlation between high IQ and like wealth in that case, right? Which is kind of like a meritocratic aristocracy in that case, right? And then the argument for meritocracy in that case then is that, well, since these children have high IQs, as we are testing right now, these are the children that deserve placement into these high elite universities. And, you know, and over time, this is the birth of a new aristocracy, right? So like, how do you balance
that? Not necessarily.
Okay. I mean, that's
aristocracy is about birthright. You could have an IQ of 78, like I think Charles the Fifth or something. Some king was like basically born mentally deformed, and he's still
like
king.
10 generations of inbreeding.
Because of 10 generations of inbreeding, that's aristocracy. That's what we want to avoid, because we would prefer what my ideal vision for America is. That the people with the best talent are given the resources to use their talent for the good of others. If you want to know my principle, that's my principle.
Okay. I'm interested in reading your book when it comes out, because I thought that was another key point in the whole affirmative action debate that was getting completely lost. That, you know, as it is right now, this fight over Harvard is a very elite problem. Right. It's a battle that concerns mostly, you know, the children who have the means to even get to Harvard's doorstep to begin with, when the real, like, bolstering K through 12 education and flattening out, you know, inequities in education at that level kind of obviates the need for affirmative action. Then finally, everyone is competing on the same footing. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on that. Just as it is right now, like, we already know that, you know, class ascendancy, like class mobility, is pretty much at a standstill, right? Where you are born kind of very closely dictates where you will end up, right? So, you know, I have a problem with using just a metric like IQ, because it just is so socially and economically mediated, that's really hard for me to try to step back and be able to even parse, like, which part is biological, which part is social. Like, to me, that's not it. Given the society we live in, that's just not a meaningful distinction that I would make. When we flatten it all out, then it'll be really interesting to see how the IQ argument shakes out, for sure. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different ways to interpret that. Like taking at face value that there is like a data of difference, right? I mean, I don't think that necessarily invalidates the idea that racism is playing a part in that. If not racism in the immediate present, which is all around us, but also historical racism. These are left narratives that I think have truth to them. Yeah. And I am not red-pilled enough or black-pilled enough or whatever to just say that everything coming out of the progressive left is bullshit, right? I mean, they have their points. They have their view of history that makes a lot of sense to me as well. The problem, I think, is this notion that, you know, we could correct for that by, you know, hitting like reset at a certain point. And saying like, okay, well, if we get enough, black people into Harvard at a certain point, we'll just kind of like, you know, we'll fix that problem. And that's not obviously not how that's going to work, right? Like, if there's a lot of racial inequity in terms of educational outcomes starting young, you know, for those who just kind of fall back on the idea that this is like, you know, genetically determined, that to me gets to a point where I'm like, yeah, we're going Charles Murray here. Like, this is race science. I'm not a believer in that. I think his, you know, I think his interpretations of that are quite
just
off.
Just because this is why I would say, is that a conservative idea or a liberal idea? Just because I said IQ is real doesn't mean that I believe every right wing thing said about it. Like, for example, a socialist could admit that IQ is real. And then say, because IQ is real, we need to live in a society that diminishes the influence of genetics on your total upbringing or on your total opportunities given. So socialists would say, we need to make a society that is sort of flexible to IQ. Basically, you don't have to have super high mental capacity inborn to do well in our country. And that would be a valid position. I disagree with it, but it would be a valid position. My position on that is I think that there is a place for equal opportunity, and then there's a place for meritocracy, and you need both for a healthy, harmonious, diverse, and a strong, excellent country. So at the K-12 level, like, I do think that people should be guaranteed, you know, access to public education in our country. I'm still a believer in public education. A lot of people aren't on the right. I'm still a believer that people should be guaranteed access to, you know, fair public education. But if people choose to study really hard and therefore develop a better IQ, because IQ is partially environmental, because they're studying really hard, then they should get to those universities on their merit, because supposedly the idea goes they can contribute more to society off of their intellect. Just like people who develop their muscles can contribute more to society as a builder or construction workers. People who develop their business acumen can contribute more in financial dealings. So I don't believe in equity in every place. I believe in equality of opportunity followed by meritocracy, competitive meritocracy.
I believe, that is very fair. I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I like the positioning of IQ as a loose roll-up metric for cognitive ability, but not something that's necessarily just inborn. I think when we talk about, I think the American preoccupation with IQ is the assumption that it's a fixed quantity in you that can only be revealed or submerged. But I like the idea, but it's a muscle that you can develop much like any other. You can maximize. Everyone has different ceilings, but everyone can maximize their capabilities. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair.
I think it's more rhetorically satisfying, this notion of equal opportunity, but, you know, not equal outcomes. I mean, I think it's rhetorically satisfying, but I don't think it's quite resolving the problem, because, like, the issue with that framing is this presupposition that we could distinguish what's an outcome from what's an opportunity. But, you know, everything at some level is both, right? Everything at some level is setting every moment, every outcome is going to affect future outcomes from there. Right. So, you know, you could call getting into Harvard an outcome. You could also call it an opportunity. And everything, you know, post-college and pre-college can be the same thing. Getting a certain job could be an outcome, but it's also an opportunity. Making a lot of money is an outcome, but it's also an opportunity for those of who have the benefit of that, you know, your children. So I think that I've heard that formulation a lot. I think it's trending a little bit more right, though it is a classically liberal position, right? But I do find that it is more rhetorically snappy than it is practical in real life. So I think
recursive.
That, I don't think it's a great starting point for a principle, but I understand the point. I think it's a guide, but I don't think that it can resolve, you know, really fine-grained disputes and things like that.
Do you believe in entirely equal outcomes, or where do you draw the line?
Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know the answer. All right. I don't have an answer. I'm more comfortable saying that I think we're up Schitt's Creek to a large degree without an oar. Like, I don't know if there's easy answers. I do understand why people say that, because it's a good starting point to start thinking about things, but it quickly runs into problems, I think.
It's a fundamental unease with the concept of a hierarchical society.
Could be. Yeah.
I think so. Because, I mean, if we're talking about meritocracy, like in Kenny's articulation here, that we want to identify the most talented people who we are assuming will be the most capable of improving society. And that's the crux of the focus here. We're still articulating a hierarchy-based society where there will be people at the top being in positions of leadership, management, you know, innovation, all of that, and people who are essentially going to be ruled by them. We just want a little bit more say over the ruling class.
A multiple hierarchy society. That's the difference, because sort of what you said is like people are ruled, but the thing is people can be ruled in one respect, but rulers in another respect.
Absolutely. We live in a very, very complex society. I think America is very definitively against like birthright hierarchy, right? The American social experiment is very, very clear on that. We reject the notion of a king. We reject the legitimacy of, you know, inherited power. We seem to be getting dangerously close to accepting the legitimacy of inherited wealth. But, you know, we'll leave that for another topic. But I think it's just central to the, like, a little bit of unease. Like, are we flattening society with these equity measures, or are we just trying to articulate a better, a more equitable, a hierarchy that mm-hmm. we can better live with? I don't know. Like, I don't think there is an answer to that, because, you know, like, I don't know if I actually want to be ruled by society's smartest people. Those tend to also be the psychopaths of us, you know?
Yeah.
There's no answer to this, I think.
Don't worry about that. You have Joe Biden. Anyway, go ahead.
That comforts my cold, shriveled heart.
Joe Biden terrifies me.
oh my God.
He's terrifying. But no, yeah. I think, you know, here's the thing is, like, this is starting to stray a bit from our original topic, which I think is good, though, because I think we need to expand, you know, our zone of comfort in terms of, like, what we weigh in on and, you know, what we think of as our interests. So I like thinking mm-hmm. big. I like Asians thinking big.
All right. That's the end of part one of a 2-part podcast. The second part of this will be available on our Patreon feed. And if you want to support us on Patreon, go to patreon.com/planamag.